I'm Jeff Brownis, and you're listening to Improv Nerd.
Jimmy, Jimmy Crane, Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Jimmy Crane's an improv nerd. Jimmy Crane's a nerd.
Oh, hey everybody, this is Jimmy Crane, and you're listening to another episode of Improv Nerd, sponsored by the good people at Pan Theater in Oakland. Now, if you're in the San Francisco Bay Area and you're looking to get your improv fix in, I want you to check out Pan's Improv Dojo Drop-In Class. It's a fun chance to laugh and play. Also, be sure to check out Pan's quarterly auditions for house teams, Awkward Face, Liquid Mind, and Sunday Brunch. All you need to do is go to their website, pantheater.com, for details. Now, Pan Theater has been bringing improv goodness to the San Francisco Bay Area for over a decade. Just visit pantheater.com for current shows and class schedules. But wait, there's more. Pan Theater offers master-level workshops with leading guest instructors, including me, Jimmy Crane, the improv nerd. I've been there three times already last year. All you need to do is go to pantheater.com for upcoming master-level workshops. One more time, that's pantheater.com. Today's episode is also sponsored by FemProv Fest 15, which will be taking place April 30th through May 3rd in beautiful downtown San Francisco. The festival is now accepting submissions from diverse all-lady improv ensembles, comics, and performance artists. Application for all-lady acts will be accepted until February 2nd. Submit through the National Improv Network. You don't have much time. For more information, go to FemProvFest.com. That's FemProvFest.com. We have another great episode of Improv Nerd for you. We deliver, don't we? I mean, we don't disappoint. Our guest today is Jack Brownis. And Jack is easily one of the best improv teachers out there today. I've sat in on his classes. He does not let his students get away with much. He makes sure they don't try to be funny. And he gets just amazing results from his students. He currently teaches at the Second City Training Center here in Chicago. And I've had the privilege to work with him both as a teacher and director, and have got to improvise along with him. He's influenced me tremendously, both as an improviser and as a teacher. And he's not only a master teacher, but he's a great improviser and actor as well. He recently had shingles. And he's been out of commission for a while. He hasn't been teaching or performing. So we talked to him about that and how that may alter his career path. We also talked to him about trying to find the joy in improv and why he performs in his socks. But before we get to the episode with Jack, the other night Lauren and I got in the car to drive to our couples therapy. Now, we're running late. And we're running late because Lauren's always late. Now, I'm not saying I'm always on time, but I'm far more on time person in the couple. So she gets in the car and she looks at the dashboard and she sees the little icon lit up that means that we are out of gas. And she goes, "We need to get gas." Now, that is not the full story, because there's also, below it, there's a gas gauge. And the gas gauge says there is one bar left until empty. And I'm a gambler, and I am willing to risk it. Lauren, on the other hand, is totally paranoid. I don't know where she gets this fear, but she thinks we're always going to run out of gas. I've been living I've been living on E my whole life. I get it. I know how far you can go. Call it a gift. Maybe it's instinct. I don't know. But I know how far you can push it. And this isn't the first time we've had this kind of argument before. This is an ongoing argument in our life. She is so adamant. She's like, "We have got to stop and get gas." And I'm like, "No, we don't have to stop and get gas." She goes, "I am making the decision. We've got to stop and get gas." And I'm like, "No, we're not stopping and getting gas. We're late. We're late because of you." And then this is where the miracle is. And for me, this is a total miracle because I am a slash and burn person. I am like, it's my way or the highway. I don't know if this was inspired by the universe or God or whatever you call your higher power. But all of a sudden, I came up with this. I said, "You know what?" And I'm presenting it calmly, but I didn't present it calmly. It was more like, "How about if we stop for $10? We'll get $10 worth of gas." And she was like, "Okay, we'll get $10 worth of gas." So we pull out of the driveway. And I'm still feeling angry about this exchange. And we're about four or five blocks away from the house now, and I look at the gas gauge, and that the one bar that was left is now gone. And now I'm starting to feel anxiety. I'm like, and I'm not trusting myself. I'm like, oh, my God, what if we run out of gas? What if I was wrong, you know? And it's one thing to run out of gas when you're alone and nobody can see you. But it's another thing when you run out of gas and somebody in the car has warned you that you're going to run out of gas. You want to avoid that at all costs. So I'm getting paranoid now. I'm thinking, oh, shit, we may run out of gas. Lauren might be right. So I see the first gas station, and I pull right into it, even though it was more than I wanted to pay. And I know if I would have waited about a mile and a half down the road, I could have gotten the cheaper gas. But I didn't want to take any chances. So I get out of the car. Fill her up, give the guy $10, get back in the car. We got plenty of time to get to our couples therapy. And I felt compelled to say this. And I said, you know what, Lauren? I think you were right. We should have gotten gas. We probably would have run out of gas. It pained me to say that. I didn't really have my heart into it, but I said it. And the point is, I still don't know how to be in a relationship. Here you go. You're going to love this episode. Jack Bronis is a wonderful teacher, improviser, and person. Please enjoy the Jack Bronis episode.
Jimmy's a nerd. He's a nerd. Oh, yeah. Jimmy's a nerd. He's a nerd.
Thank you. Jack, thank you for doing the show.
Of course.
Okay. Let's just talk about your health for just a second.
Okay.
Okay? Because your face is frozen on one side.
Yes, it is.
Okay. So tell us what you've been dealing with the last 10 weeks.
I had a root canal, which then turned into shingles, which then turned into something called Ramsey-Hunt syndrome, which attacks the nerve. And you get facial paralysis and hearing loss. And so that's what I've been dealing with.
And like 90% of your hearing is lost in that ear?
In the right ear, yes, right now.
And are you in any pain?
Yes.
Okay. What's the pain like?
What a Jimmy question.
Right.
You want to revel in my pain?
Yes, I do.
It's a dull, throbbing pain. If a doctor were asking me, is what I would tell them.
Mm-hmm. So let's start. Was this a big deal to like, because this weekend you performed and you taught, and you hadn't done that for a couple months.
Yes, that's correct.
What's it like going out in public and...
I feel like I'm a monster. Don't look at me. It was fine. Everyone dealt with it fine, and I was exhausted after I taught.
Mm-hmm. So let's start with you grew up.
Yes, I did grow up.
You did grow up.
I don't know. Some people don't. You know,
I haven't grown up, Jack. Okay. I still have
I'm
a lot.
I'm growing up.
Yes. You grew up in Lathrop Homes, is that right?
Lathrop.
Lathrop Homes.
Lathrop. There's a P on the end.
Okay. Which was on Chicago's north side.
Yes.
And your parents were immigrants, and they only spoke Polish.
Yes.
What was that like?
Well, you know, everybody has their own circumstances, and so that's what you deal. That's what you get used to, and so it was interesting. But it made me feel like I was always an outsider.
Was there some shame? Because I know, like, in terms of, like, immigrants, like, the people that came from houses where they only spoke a certain language, then when their kids went to school, there was that shame that the parents only spoke a foreign language. Did you experience any of that?
I don't know. A little bit, maybe. I guess I wasn't that ashamed of it, you know? It helps. I mean, I think if you learn more than one language as a child, it's much easier to learn dialects. It's much easier to, you know, do different kinds of voices because there's a magic age, the age of 13. If you learn a language before the age of 13, you will probably not have an accent in that language. And so because at that age, our brain kind of hardens and you can't hear sounds. So I think I'm lucky in that I'm able to do lots of dialects, and that's what I attribute it to.
And it's not just limited to Polish.
Uh-huh.
Accents, you do Irish, you do all of that, right?
Yeah, right, yeah.
And then, I love this, your father was 64 when he had you.
Yes, so you have some time.
Yes.
As do I.
Yes. What was that like with older parents?
again, it's what you're used to, you know? I mean, my father was 64 when I was born, so he was 74 when I was 10. So that was, I mean, a considerable generation gap, you know? So, I mean, as a teenager, you know, I'm smoking pot, and my dad's 78 years old, and, you know, so.
Did you do a lot of drugs when you were growing up?
Not a lot, some.
Did you get in a lot of trouble in 'cause
I got in some trouble.
Like what kind of stuff?
Not a lot. We would throw throw snowballs at police cars, things like that.
Well, today, that's harmless stuff.
It is harmless. There was no get you shot today.
And then you studied to be a journalist.
I did.
And what happened?
Well, I my majors were English literature and psychology, and I always thought I wanted to be a journalist, and so I ended up in Rome, where Loyola had a campus, and I worked as a journalist for a short time.
How did you find theater and improv?
I came home to Chicago and would go see things and think, man, I could do that.
What did you see specifically?
I guess the one that sort of stands out to me is what is now the ETC space. Wasn't the ET space at the time. It was the Practical Theater Company. And I saw a show of theirs and really liked it. And
was that with like Julia Louise Dreyfus?
Uh-huh.
And her husband was Rick? Gary Kroger was in that too?
Yes, it's okay. Not Rick Hall, but his last name is Hall. Yeah, I can't remember.
And what was it about that show? Because that was almost like a little different than Second City, but it was Second City. These guys came out of Northwestern, right?
Right. It was just, you know, and I had gone to see Second City shows as well, but that was the first time where I sort of thought, that's a possibility. I could do that. I do voices. I do dialects. I can, I have no use for them. I irritate my friends with them. So that's when I started doing it.
Did you make fun of people growing up? Like imitate people?
Yes.
Like who?
I don't know, my teachers, and I think that's one way I found acceptance was just being funny, trying to be funny.
But you were also a good student, right?
Yes.
And then, so you see the Practical Theater Company, then what do you do after that?
I started taking classes. I took classes at the Second City. At that time, there wasn't a conservatory. It was just Donnie DiPaolo doing classes on Saturday mornings, but eventually Sheldon took over.
Sheldon Patinkin.
And he was basically, so I was in the very first conservatory class at the Second City.
Now, what was that like? Because you, in your graduating class, it was like Bonnie Hunt, Dave Pasquese, Joel Murray. What was that like?
It was fun. It was a blast until eventually you get tired of it and you want to move on to something else. But For the most of it, it was a blast.
And you got to work with Sheldon.
Yes.
What made, because I never got a chance to work with Sheldon.
Uh-huh.
What made him so great?
He was no nonsense. He didn't put up with bullshit. And he didn't put up with bullshit in the work either. And he gave you a really clear sense of what satire is. You know, a really clear sense of the definitions of different things, you know. So he made it really clear to us, you're doing a parody. We don't do parodies here at Second City. We do satire. Satire is a bigger thing. And so that was great.
What is the difference between parody and satire?
Parody is you're copying something. Someone's done most of the work for you, in a sense, you know. Not that I haven't done parodies and love doing them, but if you're doing a style within somebody else's framework, well, somebody else has done some of the work for you. Satire is you're making an actual point about society.
Have we lost that a little?
I think so.
Why do you think that is?
One of the things that I do when I teach is in almost every level, even if they're beginners,
This is at Second City.
At Second City. When I teach improv, I almost always talk about archetype, because I think that's something that we have forgotten as improvisers, that when you're up on a stage, it's not just two guys on a stage, it is two symbols of two types of people, right? One person might be the dreamer, one person might be the realist, one person might be the coward, one person might, you know, and so that's always in the back of my head, and I think improvisers just now tend to, especially when they're first starting out, go up and like, okay, we're gonna do two funny guys. Like, okay, but what's the point? What are you saying, right? I think the point of comedy is to illustrate a point, to teach and to entertain, both.
Okay, the teaching part, explain that, because I don't think people, I don't even get that. What are we teaching by improvising? Because a lot of people think, just like
the truth about humanity.
Well,
okay, let's go back to the archetype that I was talking about. The most one of the most important archetypes in comedy is the fool. And back when there were kings and courts and all that, the fool had two functions. One was to entertain, but that was actually his second function. The first function was to tell the truth, to tell the king what was actually happening in the kingdom. He was supposed to do it in an entertaining way. And that is our job as comedians, is to tell the truth about what's going on in society. And thus, incrementally, slowly change things, you know?
So how do you do it, Jack, without, because I've seen a lot of improv where they hit it over the head.
Yeah.
They're trying to teach you a lesson, yeah, or they're trying to say something. How do you do it where you're not doing it that way?
I think eventually you learn, well, hopefully you learn not to do that. You learn to do it with subtlety. I mean, you know, if you're hitting it over the head with a hammer, then you're doing it wrong.
Is one way to get there is through character?
I think so. Character, emotion, truth, no bullshit. You know, I see too many scenes where it's for, like, here's the thing. When you're a beginning improviser and you're in your first couple years, you're not as good as you think you are. Always. You know, because there's always stuff to learn. You know, whether it's that your styles have to match if you're improvising, you know, like different things that beginning improvisers just don't think about. All too often, it's four people standing on a stage trying to outquip each other.
And what do you do when you have that in your class? You've got four people on stage, and all they care about is who's funny or who's clever.
I right from the beginning, I tell them not to worry about being funny.
People say that all the time, but how do you, I mean, I hear that all the time.
I'll tell someone, bullshit, you know, that's bullshit. I don't believe what you just said, because that is not within the physics of our universe.
Well, give me an example.
You know, like, if somebody, I don't know, if somebody says that the manhole cover is really a flying saucer or something, and it's like, well, there's no point to saying that, and it's just your brain trying to be funny, you know, and it isn't life, you know. I think, you know how it is when you're in a really good scene, you're basically in a trance.
Yes.
You know, and I think the best way, the quickest way to get into that is to play the truth, you know, because then you draw both people who are all three or whoever, however many people are in the scene. And then if we're successful, you draw the audience into the scene, into that trance.
I totally agree with you. And what do you mean by playing the truth? Because that's a huge concept.
It is a huge concept. And of course, it's the truth of that person in that moment. Personally, I don't like things that are sort of non, I don't know how to describe this. I mean, all too often I see improv where every single scene is something nonsensical. And I think after a point, you sort of lose your audience because they sort of become inured to that and used to that, and that's what they expect, and then it's not really human, you know? I think our job is to get to the human aspect of things.
So then you also were part of a group called Noble Fools.
Yes.
And you guys did this...
The Noble Fool.
The Noble Fool.
Yeah.
That, and you, my God, a lot of... you looked over these questions before. And
I did.
Why was
you
that?
Left them on the table.
Yeah. I thought that was interesting. And you were going through and going, oh, that's a typo, that's a typo. They wouldn't say that. Why did you, besides leaving it on the table?
Because I'm compulsive that way.
Compulsive, or you were scared, or
controlling? Oh, no, not scared. Compulsive.
How does your compulsion show up besides looking?
If you leave something on a fucking table, I'll read it.
And I didn't know. I wanted to say don't look at it, but I thought, you know what, I don't need to. It'll just challenge me to try to throw Jack off a little.
All right, then.
Okay. So you were part of the Noble Fools, and you guys created this thing called, it was an improvised funeral, I believe, Flanagan's Wake.
Yes.
And what made that show work so well?
It captured the spirit of the times, I think. Well, you know, part of it was like, you know, fucking river dance, you know, like even that, like there was this embracing of Irish culture. We had always loved doing Irish scenes.
You love doing, when I improvised with you, you love the Irish accent character guy.
I do. Because there is something about, like, you slip into that accent, and suddenly, all of a sudden, you're just way more articulate. You're way more, you use way more hyperbole. You exaggerate, and you make things, but it's still, it's fun to do, I don't know. And we were good at it, so the chronology is actually backwards. We actually did Flanagan's Wake, and that led to Noble Fool.
And then you guys opened this great theater, I forget, it was like 10 years ago.
Yes.
In the Loop. I mean, it was like a $1 million theater.
Yes.
In the section now that's considered Chicago Broadway. There's a lot of theaters and
right.
stuff like that.
Yeah.
That was a huge thing for that,
yes.
for your theater company.
Yes,
it and
was.
I remember talking to you after it closed and how down you were about it.
Yeah.
Can you tell us how that came about? Because that's a really huge achievement.
It was a really huge achievement, and and I loved the people that we were in that theater company, and most of them, and it was like a dysfunctional family in some ways, but I think we were sort of depending on corporate money, because it was a really small theater, and 9/11 happened, and so corporate money just went, and so we survived for a couple of years, but then had to close because we couldn't afford the rent.
What did you? Because I think didn't they put like $1 million something into that space?
Couple million.
It was beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
What did you learn from that experience?
Don't ever open a theater.
are you serious?
For
you?
As Paul Botts, who was our chairman of the board, said, the best way to make $1 million in theater is to start with $10 million. So,
would you have done anything differently?
No, I'll say no.
How'd you end up teaching at Second City?
Martin DeMott hired my then wife, Pat, and myself. Pat Musker, who is a great improviser.
And a great teacher. I got
yes.
An opportunity to co-teach with her when I taught at Second City. It was a blast.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we would commute to Cleveland. They had opened a training center in Cleveland, so when we first started, we Saturday mornings, we'd fly to Cleveland, mm-hmm. teach a few classes, fly back in the evening, and then Second City just hired us as regular teachers.
And so you started to teach at Second City.
Yes.
And then you and Pat get married, right? Were you married before that?
We were married before that.
Mm-hmm. And what was it like teaching at Second City here in Chicago?
It's great. I love it.
What do you love about it?
I love seeing the aha moment.
Now, everybody who works at Second City always talks about the aha moment, and everyone has a different definition of the aha moment. What is the aha moment for you?
When you see a student finally grasp a concept, when you see them understand what it is you're talking about that you've been talking about for 8 weeks, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, and they're doing it right.
Can you give us an example?
You and these examples. Just seeing somebody finally, being able to use their emotion, being able to, I teach every class improvisationally in the sense that as a teacher, I think I'm an improviser. I don't go into a class necessarily knowing what I'm going to teach that day. It just sort of depends on what I feel they need. And so when that happens, it's just such a blast when they actually get it.
Now, how are you able to do that at a place that's more institutionalized, where you're teaching them in level B, and you need to teach them certain things so they can go on to level C. How do you still improvise in an institution like Second City?
I don't think it's that difficult. I just think you have to have a lot of games or exercises to draw from. And then you sort of pick and choose as to what you need at that moment.
Now, the other thing I find interesting with you is you improvise in your socks.
I do.
Now, what is? Tell me a little about that.
The point of shoes is to get you from one place to another. Once you're at that place, you don't need the shoes anymore.
It's that simple? Did you always improvise in your with no shoes?
No. It's also, I'm a big guy. I sweat. It's a temperature control thing, too.
And how does it control the temperature?
You don't get as hot if you're not wearing shoes.
All right, so we are going to, speaking of improvising, we're going to do it right now.
What the?
What the? now, you're this year, you
No, this year.
This year. Okay, so the podcast, that would be the right ear. They're not going to even understand it because it's being recorded, but on video they may. I'm confused, Jack. How do you've done a couple shows now.
Three shows
with 90% lost hearing. How have you had to adjust?
I can't necessarily tell where a voice is coming from right now. But other than that, I think I've been able to adjust.
And is there anything like, we were talking backstage, well, what am I going to do? A little fear, like, what am I going to do for a career and stuff like that? Mm-hmm. Like a career change?
Well, I may, if this face thing doesn't change, if it doesn't heal, and if my ear doesn't heal, I may have to think about doing something else and writing, for example. I mean, which doesn't scare me because I consider myself a writer.
What would you miss about it if you had to give it up?
The joy of performing.
Now, John Hildreth and I worked with you, and you nailed both of us, especially me. I have such a hard time getting in touch with the joy when I improvise.
Yes, you do.
Thank you for that, Jack.
You're very welcome.
You're absolutely right.
I try not to bullshit.
Right, I appreciate that about you. That's okay. What I appreciate. What do you think is blocking me from that joy?
You. Well, whatever demons you have, whatever insecurities you have, I mean, we all carry them with us, right? We all have. But so much, I mean, you know this too. I mean, just from teaching, so much of teaching improv is battling people's fear. You know, it's hard for me to say F words right now, which is unfortunate. But it's fear. There's so much fear that goes into people's inability to communicate when they're improvising.
Okay, so as we're doing this now, mm-hmm. How would you give me a little suggestion to tap in to more joy?
You are a jerk.
Why am I a jerk in this moment?
No. I was making a passive aggressive joke.
Are you passive? Are you passive aggressive?
No.
Okay.
I don't think I am.
Okay. I am. I'm totally passive aggressive.
Are you really?
Mm-hmm.
Is that why you're interviewing me?
Probably. Yeah.
Okay. What was the question?
How can I tap into some more joy when we improvise?
I think you know this already. I think you have to make a conscious choice. You know, I think it has to be a conscious choice. Remember, I saw that aha moment with you that day when I told you and John Hildreth that you both sort of play in heavy sigh, mm-hmm. right?
I love that, yeah. I live in heavy sigh.
You live in
I
heavy
was
sigh.
I born in heavy sigh.
I know, and yeah. Heavy sigh is what you're used to, and heavy sigh is what you need to get out of, you know?
Why do I go to heavy sigh? Because it works?
Because it's what you're accustomed to, and it's what you like on some level. It's because you're comfortable with it. I think
you're absolutely right. So I'm going to bring some more joy to this when we're about to improvise.
Okay.
And you're just saying it's a conscious choice. So I'm going to just say, turn off heavy sigh and then tap into the joy.
I would love to see that.
Okay. I don't know why I resist it so much.
Because it's what you, again, it's comfort. It's mm-hmm. what you're used to. And, you know, a lot of us, especially if you're depressive, you hang on to it because it's what you know.
Mm-hmm. I am very depressive.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Are you depressed? You talked about depression too.
Yes, I am a depressive.
And how does your depression show up?
I hate winter. Winter.
Okay. Me too.
Yeah, I shouldn't be living in Chicago. I don't want to get out of bed. I don't want to do anything, or you know. So it is that kind of
thing. Suicidal thoughts at all?
Not really. No.
Okay.
No.
Okay. I have better. I have suicidal thoughts.
Oh yeah, you're better. That's better. That's way better, Jimmy.
Yeah.
You're better.
Yeah.
That's what I mean. You're holding on to it.
Yeah.
You know, even at a subconscious level.
I wanted to.
I'm better. I have suicidal thoughts all the time.
I really want to let go of it. I do, Jack. I really do.
I think it's a conscious choice.
Okay. So we're going to make a conscious choice here.
Okay.
Of bringing some joy to this improv scene.
Okay.
If it kills me.
Okay.
And,
which it might.
It probably will. So we're going to take a, how do you want to start?
Any way you want to start.
Okay. Could we have a suggestion, please?
Fern.
So you hear fern. All right. What do you do with it in terms of suggestion?
Fern, you know, the first thing that comes to mind is one of those restaurants that has ferns.
Mm-hmm.
other than that, I might start somewhere there, we're in one of those restaurants.
So when I hear you say fern and I hear restaurant, I think, okay, I'm going to go and play the manager that's always pissed off, which is where I always go.
Okay.
Okay, if I'm going to play joy,
okay,
how do I need to shift?
Well, what's the opposite of that?
Guy who loves his job.
All right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Or a customer who loves his job. We won't know, but
yeah,
someone
exactly.
who loves whatever.
Exactly.
Okay?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Are you ready?
Yeah.
It's good you came in early today.
Oh, I love to come in early, yeah. Mr. Sanchez.
Yes. We've got a party of 10. For a birthday
party. Oh, for real 10!
Yes.
I am going to make my chimichangas for this party, Mr. Gomez. I am going to do it.
Great. That's awesome. I'm so excited about that. You're chopping so well.
Are we going to really talk about what I'm doing?
No, we are not. No, we are not going
we
to
know.
Do that. No.
Because you did that yesterday.
I stood around
for 6 hours talking about what I was doing.
I know. And the thing is, I don't know how to communicate with people.
You communicate good.
I want to say that I really appreciate what you do here. I could not be such a success if it was not for you.
Well, that's true. I've been meaning to talk to you. Maria has asked me if I could if you could give me a little bit more money.
Is she pregnant?
Yes.
Oh my God, congratulations.
No,
yes.
I actually lied right there. She's not pregnant, but I want more money.
No. That is fine that you
We
lie.
Want to get pregnant.
No. I know, I understand. We're trying to. Here.
Do you use the turkey baster thing?
Yes.
Oh, yes.
I take it from at the work here. But anyways, look. It doesn't matter.
Why are you using a turkey baster instead of your penis?
IUD or something like that. Let me tell you something. Listen.
IUD?
Look. We went once to fertility clinic,
Uterine devices, IUD.
Yes, that's what it is.
Yeah,
but they charge thousands of dollars, right? So
Isn't that to prevent pregnancy?
No, IUD is to prevent. You're right. You're so right. That's why.
That's why you're not getting
right,
pregnant.
Exactly.
That's right. Take out the IUD.
All
Don't
right.
use
yes.
the turkey baster.
Yes.
Use your penis.
Yes. You are smart. You are wise. You deserve a raise just for that.
Okay.
40 cents more an hour. Is that what you were thinking?
I'll take it for now.
Great.
Christmas is coming up, so
I will get you a Christmas gift.
Oh, that's wonderful.
I will get you a tree for you and Maria, and your soon to and ornaments for your soon to be child.
Oh, thank you so much. You're not the best patron I've ever had, but you're probably the third or fourth.
I appreciate your compliments. All right, so we've got this party, you know. It's going to be a big party. It's the Schultzes. They will be in here.
Yes, I know.
All right.
You know, we are still talking about what we are doing.
I know. I don't know why I do that so much. It's so stupid on my part. Because I get close to someone, and then I want to avoid them. My wife, you know, we all
you
of a sudden...
You get close to someone, and you want to avoid them.
Yes. I want to push them away. I am afraid of intimacy.
Well, that's very passive-aggressive of you.
Oh, I'm very passive-aggressive. In my country, it was rewarded.
So, in El Salvador, they
Yes. Yes, they do.
So, are you pushing me away by
giving me
a raise?
Yes. I want to give you the biggest raise in the world that you never come back.
40 cents is not the biggest raise in the world.
In El Salvador, you can buy a lot for 40 cents. You can buy a house.
We are not in El Salvador.
I know we're here in America. I am not going to talk about what you're doing. I'm going to resist that temptation that I had right now. I so badly want to talk about you cutting that onion up, but I am not going to do that.
Please.
Because I want to get closer to you.
Okay.
I want to tell you something. I have not told anybody. Nobody.
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 What is it?
When I was a child, my father, he said to me that I was a mistake, that he wanted a girl instead of me. And I've held on to that my whole life. But you know what?
What?
I did not make it something that I would feel sorry for myself or I would be depressed about. I celebrated that. That is what made me a success. I wanted to prove to my father that I could open a restaurant here in America.
And you did.
And I did. And you know what? I look back at that time he told me he wanted a daughter, that I was a mistake, and I realized I was not a mistake. It's here in your heart. No one, listen, can tell you that you are a mistake. Only you.
Are you telling me I'm a mistake?
No. No. I'm telling you, you're a wonderful person.
Thank you. You know, sometimes I get self-conscious when I'm cooking and you're watching me.
I know that. I do that because I wish I could cut like you cut. But my arm.
Yes, your carpal tunnel.
Yes.
I'm very sorry about that. I'm not going to ask how you got your carpal tunnel.
I will tell you. I have not told anybody. It is between me and you and the lamppost.
You are giving away a lot of secrets today.
Yes. When my wife, Consuela, does not want to have sexual intercourse.
She is beautiful, Consuela.
She is gorgeous.
Yes.
She is the most beautiful woman I have ever seen in my life. But sometimes women, they don't want to have sex. Sometimes.
Consuela doesn't want to have
sometimes
sex.
Sometimes she does not.
Consuela.
Yes.
We're talking about the same Consuela.
Yes, we are talking about Consuela. It's between you and me. Because we are brothers, right?
Yes.
So, I go down into my den, and I type. I type. I say Consuela does not want to have sex with me. Over and over and over and over again.
Why are you reinforcing that in your head?
Because it makes me feel alive.
That Consuela doesn't want to have sex with
yes,
you.
Yes, because I realize that it is a mirage.
What is a mirage?
That Consuela doesn't want to have sex with me at that moment. At that moment. You see?
But that is the reality of the moment.
Oh, yes. But, now listen here. The moment doesn't last forever. Because I do it 100, 300 times. For some reason, I go back up to my lair, and I lay on my bed, and Consuela, she wants me more than ever. She's all over me. She, what do you kids say, jumped my bones. You're so tempting when you scrape that onion into the bowl.
I really need to talk about what we're doing again.
I know. When I reveal myself like that, I want to talk about things to avoid it. I just opened my whole soul up to you. No one's known that.
Thank you. I appreciate you letting me know you. This is how intimacy with people starts. You tell things about yourself.
You know how we build trust in my country? I tell two secrets. You tell a secret.
This is an El Salvadoran custom.
Yes, it is. It is either that or we cut our hands and we put our blood together. It is your choice.
I'm not 5 years old. I'm not doing this. And so I will tell you a secret.
It's got to be good.
I don't know. Good. What is good is a relative term.
You're right, it is.
You're talking about secrets.
Yes.
I'm allergic to onions. And yet I deal with them all the time. It's not a big secret.
No, but this is an important secret. Because you've worked in here now 12 years.
Yes.
I never knew that about you. Okay. And I've asked you, to cut onions many times. All our dishes have onions in it.
Yes. Well, I don't like to wear shoes when I'm cooking.
I know.
That's not a secret.
No, it's not a secret.
But it's not particularly hygienic, so thank you for letting me get away with it.
No, because you know why I do that? Because I love you like a son. If I have a son, I will have a son. I hope he is like you.
If I have a father, I hope he is mostly like you.
You do not have father?
Well, no, I had a father.
Yes.
But
he died.
He died. I
did not know that. That is secret.
All right.
How did he die? You don't want to talk about it? You don't have to talk about it?
No, I will talk about it. I will talk about it. It was a terrible death. He choked.
He choked?
On a tomato. It was too large for his esophagus.
Was it a restaurant?
No.
Oh, good.
No, it was a tomato that I had chopped.
Oh, my God.
Yes, I feel responsible.
But it is not your fault. He should have known to cut it in small pieces or to chew it more faster. It's not your fault.
I don't know. I'm not convinced.
No, it is not your fault.
I'm not convinced. You don't make a convincing argument.
No.
It's a tomato. Tomato is pliable.
I understand, but you're trying to hold on to it. You need to let go of it. He should have. Look. Hold it a second.
All right.
Here. This is pickle. Right?
Yes. I can see that. You don't even have to say that.
I'm saying it is pickle.
Why are you saying it's a pickle if I can see it's a pickle?
Because I'm trying to make a point to you. Okay. All right. Eat the pickle.
That sounds like a euphemism.
No, it is not euphemism. It is point. Now, you put pickle in your whole mouth, right?
Oh, okay. What this is you being passive aggressive. I don't want to put pickle in my whole mouth.
All right. You do not want, you want to hold on to your demons of the past? Here, eat the pickle. Now you're chewing it, right? You're chewing it in pieces. You didn't shove it in your mouth and choke and die and kill yourself, did you?
No, I would never do that with a pickle.
Right. That is what your father could have done, but he chose not to. Do you know what I think? Do you know what I think?
I'm very curious.
I think your father was a sick man and wanted to kill himself. And he did not have enough courage to do it, so he killed himself with a tomato, and he left you with the guilt, that shame that he had for killing himself.
I think you're right.
I know I am right. There is a story in my country about that.
In El Salvador.
In El Salvador. But it was with the donkey.
Okay, I have to hear this.
Wait, it's the same story you told. There was a kid, his name was Jeffrey.
That does not strike me as an Salvadoran.
I am translating it to American.
We don't have to. Why? We are speaking Spanish with each other now.
Right,
so.
But we are Americans.
Yes.
We both are citizens.
Yes.
In this country.
Yes.
All right. So Jeffrey.
Yes.
All right. Had a donkey, a jackass, as they say in Spanish. And he brings the jackass, right?
Yes.
To the fair.
Yes.
Right? And he gets a melon. Oh, the most ripe melon. It is a beautiful melon. It is the prettiest melon, all right? And he goes and he feeds the melon, right, to the jackass. And you know what the jackass does? He eats the whole melon. He does not eat it. He chokes to death. That is Jeffrey in the jackass story. And the boy went home. He was crying and crying and crying, you know, Spanish crying, Spanish tears. And he went to his mother and he said, "Mom, I killed the jackass." And the mother said, "You did not kill the jackass. The jackass killed himself. That is why it's called a jackass." Think about it.
I don't know what to say about this.
I have touched you. I can see it on your face. I see a tear.
It is a Spanish tear.
Tears in Spanish in America, same thing. It means joy. Some say sadness. I don't. I say it's joy.
You are the most joyous person I've ever met.
Thank you. That was a lot of fun. Did you have a good time?
I did.
Okay, what did you like about it? You love doing characters, don't you?
I do. I love doing characters. I love doing voices. It was just fun and silly, and I think I may have called you two different names right at the beginning, so that was in my head at that point, sort of right off the bat. But other than that, it was fun.
Is there any, now, when you do a scene like this or you improvise, how do you analyze it afterwards?
I used to, but not so much anymore. You know, if you work with good people, I think with good improvisers, you can have a batting average of like 800.
Are you serious?
I think so. I think with really good improvisers, you can,
Why is that, you think?
Because they know what you're, if you've worked with people for a long time and you know, I think improv is one of those sports where the harder you try, the worse you do. It's just a matter of repetition and learning and doing it over and over and over and over again, just like a batter hits a ball over and over and over again, or a golfer hits a ball over and over. It's the same thing. And eventually, once you do it enough, you see your options. You know, it's almost like it goes into slow motion and you can see which road you can take and you just choose a road. And as a beginning improviser, usually you're always afraid it's the wrong road. And there is no wrong road unless you're denying something or you know. So I think if you know the first thing you have to do as a beginning improviser is learn the rules. Know the rules backwards and forwards, because once you know them, you can break them, you can do whatever you want with them.
And it seems like the rules have changed. I mean, yes, yes. And seems to be. What are the rules like today that you think improvisers need to know?
I think yes and doesn't mean that you can't have a different opinion than somebody else. And I think beginning improvisers especially always have to, yes, the moon is made of cheese, yes, and then it goes down bullshit lane. So it's okay to have an opinion, right? Just denial is about denying facts. It's not about denying opinions. You know, you may be going out with a girl, and I think she's a complete idiot, and you think she's the best girl in the world. Nothing wrong with us having two different opinions. But, you know, if you call her Victoria and I call her Elise, that's denial.
Right, or if I say I don't have a girlfriend, what are you talking about?
Exactly, that's denial.
So that's really important.
Yeah, and just sort of, I also think, and maybe this is coming from Second City, the fact that I've worked there for so long, I also think there needs to be, you need to be aware of what you're saying. There, you know, what are you saying? What is the scene saying? Especially if you're doing a comedy review or something, what's the point of your scene?
Are you saying even in improv?
What did our
scene say?
Oh, fuck if I know. I think it was just a look into the lives of these two characters, one of which, your character seemed needier than mine did.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, your guy seemed like he was compelled to stand here and watch me cook.
Right.
I don't know. I'd have to think about it. It's a little...
Is that something improvisers should do when they're done with doing a scene? Like, okay, what was that about? Would that help them? Or...
Well, it depends. If you're just doing an improv show, I don't think you necessarily have to. But if you're using improv to write, then yes. You should, and you should also, as an improviser, I also think, what's the big picture? What does this mean? What is in the big picture? Who am I? You know, so.
In our scene, would you do anything differently?
I would try to remember your name, the name I gave you right off the bat. I would probably pay a little bit more attention to what I was cooking.
Mm-hmm. I probably would have. I would have liked to see more object work for me, because I stood for like the first 8 minutes of the scene, so that probably would have helped. Why is object work so important, you think? Because it seems like it's a lost art.
It is a lost art, and it helped you as an improviser because it gets rid of those negative nattering voices that you have in your head of, I'm doing this wrong, or I went down the wrong road. You're concentrating on whatever it is you're doing, and then you're free to react emotionally in the moment.
The other thing I would have done differently, I felt there was times where I was a little too jokey.
Yeah, we both were a little jokey.
Okay. Well, how do you adjust that?
The question I ask myself is, what would I really say?
Mm-hmm. Character or as me?
As that character, what would I really say? If I were working in this restaurant and I'd worked here for 12 years and this was my boss, and mm-hmm. You know?
Why do you think we went jokey? And for me, it was like I was having so much fun.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And I don't think you can necessarily fault us for it. I mean, we know what we're doing, and so we went there, I guess.
I always feel, because I know you have students in the audience and I have students in the audience, when I go jokey, I feel like, oh, you know what? Jimmy's really full of shit. When he teaches, he's really full of shit. Do you feel that at all?
Sometimes, you know, but on the other hand, once you know the rules, you can break the rules, you know? I always preach, be real, be honest, be whatever, but there's no reason you can't do a scene in the Gumdrop Forest or whatever. I mean, because those are fun too, and just be silly. And
now I'm kicking myself we didn't go to the Gumdrop Forest. All right, we're going to take some questions from the audience.
Great.
So if you could turn the lights up. Justin should be here with the microphone.
Here we go. I guess we're going to start it off. First question I would say, do you see the future of improv being more sort of absolutist in that there's a right way to do it, or do you still see it going the route of do whatever feels right?
I don't think there's a right way to do it. I think there are many right ways to do it. So if anyone's a guru, I don't think there are gurus. I think there are just different ways to learn it. It's all on a continuum. I think to be a good improviser, you should probably concentrate too on being a good actor.
Great. Another question? Right here, Carl.
Well, Jimmy, nobody here thinks you're full of shit, so don't worry about it.
Thank you, Carl.
Don't speak for everyone.
Okay, almost nobody. Anyway, why do you think that Chicago ended up being kind of the improv capital of the world? It seems like it is to me. I don't know if that's true or not, but why is there so much here? What do you think that's about?
Well, it just started. It just happened to start with the University of Chicago and that group of people, including Sheldon Patinkin. And, you know, the art form had existed for hundreds of years in a way, you know, if you consider Commedia dell'arte. It just happens to be that in the 1950s, when the committee started, they were in Chicago.
Have we lost our standings with New York and L.A.?
I don't think so, and not as far as the training ground. You know, in L.A., I mean, you know, it's not like L.A. improvisers are necessarily better than our improvisers, and L.A. audiences are weird, you know? I mean, they're mostly performers or people who performers want to get business from, you know. And the last improv I saw in L.A. was basically people standing on a stage trying to outquip themselves.
Great. We'll take another question.
Hi.
My wife, Lauren.
Hey, Lauren.
I wanted to know a little bit more about The Noble Fool.
Yes.
It sounds like that was a straight theater company, right?
Yes, it was. Well, it was a straight theater company dealing with comedy. Our mission was to do comedy in all its forms.
And I just wanted to know if you could talk a little bit about why you wanted to start a theater company like that.
There isn't one in Chicago. You know, I mean, there's comedy, but there isn't a theater company that does different form, like everything. Plays, you know, we did straight plays that were comedic. We did completely improvised shows. We did hybrid shows. Flanagan's Wake is mostly scripted, but about 80% scripted, 20% improvised. So we wanted to do all of it, you know.
Great. Tom?
Hi. You mentioned earlier about students that got jokey real quick. Is that a matter of teaching them patience or playing to the top of their intelligence? And which is harder to teach students?
Both of those is correct. I think what happens is they feel the pressure of, I got to be funny. And it's much easier if you're truthful. Sometimes the truth is the funniest thing you can say, which goes back to the whole fool archetype, you know, like the fool. If you look at Seinfeld, of those four characters, who's the fool? Usually Kramer. Sometimes it's George, right? But Kramer's the one who can go up to a woman and say, you need a nose job, right? Who says that? The fool says that, right? If you look at Friends, there are two fools, I think. Who are they? Joey and Phoebe, right? They're the ones who can say those things that nobody else can say, but it's the truth, but it's just, sometimes it's the goofiest truth possible.
If you think about King Lear, the fool, the part he played was the same role like that, like you said.
Well, that is the job of the fool. The job of the fool is to tell the king the truth.
Great. We got time for one more question. Over here? Great.
Would you say you have a lot of characters that are premeditated, and if you feel like you can insert them into a scene where you have a suggestion, you go ahead and reach into sort of like your Rolodex of characters and use that one, or do you just sort of like let the character?
I used to do that. Right now, I just whatever comes up, and that way I've been recently discovering a bunch of new characters that I love doing and voices and things. So I usually try not to premeditate. When I do Jimmy and Johnny, the one thing I'm always trying to do is to get Johnny to speak with an Irish accent. Because he's very resistant to that, so so Jimmy does it, Johnny won't.
what do you say to improvisers who go, but if I use stocked characters, that's cheating?
It's not cheating because you still don't know where the scene's going. You have no idea where the scene's going. You have no idea which choices you're going to make. You have no idea where, you know. So I don't think it's cheating at all. I think you have to come into a scene sort of in the middle of life, you know, and too many improv scenes start at zero as if we're on Star Trek and just sort of being
the whole like, hi, how are you? That whole introduction.
Exactly.
Thing? Yeah.
We don't need that. You know, it's start in the middle of life.
And how do you get people to start in the middle?
tell a secret, say something important, say something that's going to change your life or your partner's life. Those are great places to start. Today's the day, right? Every time you're on stage, today should be the day.
And what do you mean by that?
There should be importance to what's happening right now. Even if it's the most insignificant thing, make it important.
Like you did with about the onions, the secret you had about the onions.
Yeah.
Okay.
Or you standing there watching me.
Right. Today was the day
that
you were going to speak to me standing, watching you.
Right.
You had let this go for 12 years.
Right.
And today was the day that
you
spoke of it.
Right, yeah.
We've got to wrap this up. This was great. What piece of advice, Jack, would you give to any improviser starting out today?
Play with people better than you. I think that's the best way to get better. They're going to probably be irritated for a while, but you're going to get better.
And how do you do that? Because there's like the hierarchy. They're like, oh, they're better than me. I can't play with them. How do you do it?
Ask if you can play with them.
It's that simple?
I think so. That's how, you know, you are going to get better if you play with people who are better than you.
Great. Well, you made me better today. I love playing with you. Thank you so much. Jack Bronis.
And there you have it, another episode, can you believe it, of Improv Nerd is in the can. And I want to thank our guest today, Jack Bronis, from the Second City Training Center here in Chicago. And I loved it that he improvised in his socks. Also, I want to thank Stage 773 here in Chicago. They're our home base. They're the people that host us and treat us like such rock stars. Also, our producer, Dan Schiffmacher, who makes me sound so slick and so professional. And if you want more information about me, Jimmy Corain, and my award-winning classes, The Art of Slow Comedy, and my Improv Nerd blog, which will make you a better improviser and a better person, well, the person part is up to you. Sign up for our newsletter. Just go to my website, jimmycorain.com. You're also aware we are taking over social media, and we're doing it a piece at a time. And the first one is Facebook. Go to our Improv Nerd page and like us, because it really helps with my low self-esteem. Follow us on Twitter at improv_nerd, and then our wonderful YouTube channel, where you can see little scenes and little excerpts from our podcast, video excerpts. Also, we are fortunate and grateful and love to be part of this podcast collective called FeralAudio.com. They have some of the most innovative, unique, and hilarious podcasts today. So go to FeralAudio.com to check that out. And I'd like to thank today's sponsors of this episode, the good people at Pan Theater in Oakland. For more information, just go to pantheater.com. And FemProfest 15. For more information about FemProfest, go to FemProfest.com. And especially, I'd like to thank you for listening. And until next time, remember, walk, don't run.
Hello, I'm Kyle Ayers. I'm the host of Never Seen It, the podcast where comedians rewrite famous movies and TV shows they've never seen, and then we give them a read in studio. This is a clip I want to play for you guys from an episode where Langston Kerman rewrites Scarface. He's never seen it, but he wrote a script based on what he thinks he knows about it, and here's a clip. Give it a listen.
All right, Scarface, The New Frontier. Interior, happening discotheque. Remember when we called clubs discotheques? LOL, the 70s were crazy. Night. The crowd bustles with young, hot Mexicans who are supposed to be Cuban and all are dressed in butterfly collared shirts and pants that look like JNCO jeans and pleated khakis had a really weird baby. There's sex in the air and Poppy wants a whiff.
Oh my God.
Scarface, 22 to 45.
Like he's a television audience demographic.
Devilishly handsome. Not even a little bit Italian looking, so get that out of your dumb brain. Walks through the crowd with the confidence of a man who's going on MTV Cribs with the Ying Yang Twins one day. Does he actually have a scar on his face? Fuck no. Why would you even ask that? That's not important. What's important is that he is not at all a problematic stereotype and that he has come for his cocaine. as he approaches the red rope of the VIP, pronounced Ve A Pay in Spanish.
Oh my gosh.
He spots his dear friend, who is almost certainly going to become his enemy by the end of the film, Smooth Skin. Scarface yells out his signature line.
Ciao, Bella. It's me, Scarface.
Oh my gosh.